to the second and third intro. Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 45, where we are continuing to discuss Fred Alford's Whistleblowers, Broken Lives, and Organizational Power. To get the text, and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
So I was drawn into his book for several reasons. One of them is that he asks fundamental questions that are very important. So he asks questions about morality and about ethics. What makes us actually as ethical subjects in organizations, right? What equips us in a way, what gives us capacity to distinguish the right from wrong and act upon this? And this is at the crux of his contribution, I think, because he actually says several times in different, it's a constant, one of the constant messages or refrains even in his book. And this is that actually whistleblowers cannot disconnect, you know, the consequences that actions have for others. And he says that's a fundamental question of ethics, how our actions affect the others. You know, being able to imagine that and visualize that and being unable, as he calls it, to double down. That is, being unable to disconnect that knowledge from one's own actions. And this leads us, as some of you already have mentioned, to his theorization in chapter 6, when he talks about organizations. He actually concludes that what sets whistleblowers apart from other organizational members who turn a blind eye and therefore become thoughtless, right? What sets whistleblowers apart is that actually ability to visualize and inability to forget that picture, you know, of how our actions affect the others. Probably we can discuss how does that, because he in chapter 5 and chapter 4, fascinating, both chapters for me at least, anyway, when he talks about whistleblowers' ethics and consequences of whistleblowers' ethics for society, right? Chapter 4 and 5, respectively. But anyway, this is really quite important. He asks fundamental questions, you know? And that's why he's right in saying that looking at whistleblowers, people who actually share these two capabilities helps us and is very useful in understanding what makes us moral or ethical individuals in organizations and society. I think this is absolutely spot on, and this is a very, very relevant message, actually, and a very important message, and the lasting contribution, I would say, that won't age in a way. I mean, this will always be the question of ethics, I'd say. Well, at least for me, anyway.
So yeah, he does that, but at the same time, it's a bit difficult to almost take it seriously. He clearly has strong Orwellian influences, and I'm not sure how much it's worth talking about morality when the ontology that he paints is basically of a world where there is no justice, and how can you have morality or ethics without justice? I was reading it on a bit of a skeptical day, but it almost seems that whistleblowers...
Well, that's a great insight, Demetrius.
Yeah, it almost seems that that whistleblowers are these. What was the name of the main dude in 1984? They're these disconnected.
Winston Smith.
Yeah, borderline deluded romantics, and that whatever they do, it's not gonna make a difference, and it doesn't matter. And I'm pretty sure that's not the message he's trying to communicate with this book, but it's certainly something that can be read through it, I think. Because he says that organizations basically operate on power, not morality or justice or ethics.
Right, that they're amoral, essentially. Yeah.
So I will take this opportunity just to rewind a bit in the interest of the summary. which is we haven't talked so much about this idea he's put forward of the narcissism's moralized, you know, because while, as Mariana was saying, there is this idea that the whistleblower has this continuous, I would say, concern for the effect of things on people, it's not a concern that's necessarily built entirely or only in empathy, quite the opposite. You know, he offers this idea that whistleblowers are very much narcissistic, but of a different kind of narcissism, which in a way I think goes into what you're saying, Dimitris. He has an effort to try to complicate morality using that concept. But, you know, I'm not sure how it works necessarily, but I just wanted to expand and link.
Well, for him, it's basically that they become such the moment they moralize their belief systems.
Yes. And they can't let go, right?
So it's both ways you can look at that.
And like a narcissist, you can't let go. Yeah.
Yeah, you can look at it as a set of earnest beliefs about what's right and what's wrong, but at the same time, you can also interpret it from a fairly sociopathic perspective as well, you know, just to take a critical look
right.
at it.
Right, and I was thinking about that from the NRC inspector who, you know, essentially felt like he's describing the people that he talked to in the genetic community, and he basically goes to Jimmy Carter as his ultimate superior. I mean, there's some obsessive compulsive stuff going on there where you think you can knock on the president's door and tell him, yeah, I've got this problem, my superiors won't listen to me. So maybe that may be an extreme case there, but there's something narcissistic about that.
He's trying to talk about narcissism in a more complex way. And indeed, I think even when I teach, say, ethical leadership, right? So narcissism is it's a foundational aspect of leadership, indeed. And Alford is making that point in, say, page 77, when he says that people like Martin Luther King and Gandhi differ from Hitler, say, I mean, very extreme examples, obviously, not because they don't have, you know, the element of narcissism, not because the element of narcissism is not strong in their personalities. And that can be said for all leaders, indeed, I think. And you know, you have to have a love of the self and believe, a strong belief in the value of your own view to take that stance, right? It's just, even you know, some of the organizational theories, the more kind of, how can I say, sophisticated ones, if I may put it so, they would talk about productive
absolutely.
And dysfunctional
yes,
narcissism,
like, absolutely.
Right? And I think actually Alford here is hinting at the productive narcissism, because he really says something about narcissists have really a very strongly developed sense of ego ideal, right? I mean, he's, you know, when you send this, how can I say, guidelines about the podcast, so I went and just checked Alford even more carefully, and I was so surprised to find in his webpage, in the first sentence, how he introduced himself, that he's fascinated by psychoanalysis. I mean, for psychoanalysis is my big source of inspiration. And when I liked his book, I mean, it's not so obvious in his book that he's so fascinated. It's clear that he read psychoanalysis, but it wasn't so clear to me that he's fascinated by psychoanalysis. But in fact, he is. And now it's really clear why I like his book so much. But anyway, that's a personal remark. So he really talks about this ego ideal, which means the very strong expectations, if we may put it in simple language, we have of ourselves, which are the values that are inculcated to us according to psychoanalysis by the important others, our parents, you know, and other people who were influential, you know, who shaped us when we were very, very young. So he says that people have these very high expectations of themselves. And what really sets apart the productive narcissist from a dysfunctional narcissist is how we try to respond to those. So a whistleblower, really, for Alford, in fact, tries to really still refer to the other, but in relation to his own high expectation of himself as having to be truthful and live up to his or her own ego ideal, that is, high principles. So really, Alford makes it very clear in several points in the book that more than anything else, actually, whistleblower is actually faithful to his principles and her principles, which because she or he cannot do otherwise, he uses this concept of the choiceless choice. But what does it mean, she or he cannot do otherwise? Well, it means that the wounded narcissism is something even more unbearable than the fear of being ostracized, okay? That's what Alford says. I'm not so sure this is always the case, but actually, I think this is very, very plausible, at least in my own experience. And I know quite a few whistleblowers. I mean, not only do I know them, something that Alford is also stressing in his methodology, it's actually meeting whistleblowers in different points in time. So actually also listening to how whistleblowers speak to each other. It's so different than actually than the information you get when you interview the whistleblowers, you see. And I think it's also important in which point in time you actually speak to whistleblowers, because whistleblowing is a process, in fact, a very lengthy process. And Alford also stresses that. So, you know, you may find a whistleblower, you know, when she or he is very optimistic about, you know, the outcome of his or her actually, you know, case. And then the whistleblower disappears because she or he is suffering from depression for months. And this is the same person you wouldn't recognize, you know. So all I'm trying to say, what Alford describes, he tries not to explain whistleblowers' behaviors, but he still, in a way, does that. Now, not explicates, not explains. He differentiates between the two verbs. This is really very crucial that whistleblowers really cannot suffer, cannot live up with that sense of wounded narcissism, which is the love of self, in fact, right? In a way, to put it bluntly, they cannot live with actually not being able to look at themselves in the mirror day after day after day after day. There comes a turning point that they cannot take it anymore. And I think that's kind of, that's something that they can relate to after having spoken and actually many times to the same whistleblowers and many whistleblowers over the period of last 5 years, in fact, you know. And listen to whistleblowers and participating in fact, I have to just stress that we were granted our team was granted a unique access to whistleblowers by Whistleblowers UK, to different whistleblowers. And that means that we gained their trust, but that actually we were able to work with the same people for a prolonged period of time, the same people and new people as well. So it's kind of, you know, a longitudinal kind of view we have of whistleblowing. I mean, which really confirms what Alford is saying in this respect, I would say.
I appreciate that explanation because it does add richness to, you know, what you just read. I personally didn't get a lot out of the deep psychoanalysis, but the nice thing about, or his love affair or interest or extreme interest in psychoanalysis, I would say on the positive side that you don't have to have quite share his depth of interest in psychoanalysis to get a lot out of the book. So I don't want people who are listening to think it's all about psychoanalysis. I do believe it richens. I do believe it enriches what he talks about. And I think another theme I saw in the book is this idea of profound sense of loss. And it seems to me, on the whistleblowers, and it seems to me that it's lost at two levels, right? So there's kind of the surface level you were talking about where the job and the friends and potentially the family and family members who feel like the whistleblower betrayed them, which I thought was really interesting and of course, unfortunate. And then the second level of loss is this idea that everything you thought you knew about the world turns out not to be true. And Alford gives a list of those, and I forget exactly where that is in the book, but it's these things that I would call sort of a naive rationalism view of how the world works, right? Like if you go to your boss and tell him what's going on, things will be made right, and you'll be rewarded for being virtuous. I mean, I don't think it's wrong to believe those things, but I think when I read that list of these features of the world that seem to be part of the whistleblower's worldview, I was thinking, okay, that might be something you tell people when they first come in organizations, or you're teaching them in the high school civics class that Ralph Nader advocates. But a lot of that, it's a lot more complicated story, particularly when we talk about the feudalism of power, you know, feudal power, and you know those kinds of things. I just thought those that list of items represents a rather simplistic view of the way the world and organizations works.
I'm just still thinking about the psychoanalysis and the morality part. So in terms of kind of more traditional virtue ethics point of view, that and this is a bit out of my depth, and I don't really remember that much of this stuff. There, one of the reasons why a person would strive to be virtuous was to attain eudaimonia, so the kind of the concept of what is good for you, this version of ancient Greek happiness. But psychoanalysis, insofar as I kind of recount it at this moment, is kind of less purposeful of a stimulant for moral or amoral behavior. And Alfred clearly lands more on the psychoanalysis bit, as you described, Mariana, but I think it's very conceivable that a more kind of eudaimonic, more Aristotelian ethical picture is at play as well. That I think Ralph was talking in the beginning of the previous part about whistleblowers who are not necessarily these virtuous human beings, so that there are other varieties of them who may be more malignant in some ways or others. And I was just wondering the place of a more kind of deliberately selfish and yet still conceivably moral attitude towards whistleblowing in Alfred's kind of worldview here. Whistleblowing for the sake of making oneself happy and maybe attaining meaning, because he goes a lot about lack of meaning. So maybe kind of this more virtuous drive is plays into that as well.
Well, I think it's not just lack of meaning, which I agree with you, or to seek meaning, but also it's this idea, this drive comes, and I think Mariana was talking about earlier, is for ethical purity, right? This idea that they can't compartmentalize their personal ethics and their professional ethics. And I'm not saying you should, but they can't, because they take the approach that they've got to rise up to meet their ideal. And when Mariana was talking about that, and as well as when you were, Demetrius, there's a, I don't know if I would call it dysfunctional aspect to that. That's probably not the right way to say it, but it's more like, that's a very hard thing to do, to live in such a way that you're always seeking to elevate your behavior. And I'll give you just a quick illustration. I went to the Naval Academy in the United States, and they have there what we call an honor concept, which is basically has to do with ethical behavior. And I won't go into details of the description of it, but the idea is that you're truthful at all times. And a friend of mine, his view was, anytime you violated the regulations, now we're not talking ethics now per se. It was more like you'll show up on time, you won't take food out of the cafeteria to your room, those kinds of things. His view was, anytime you violated one of those regulations, you were committing an honor offense because you knew you were doing the wrong thing. And this person's my friend, and I don't think he was wrong exactly, but I do remember at the time thinking, wow, that's an extremely high bar, because essentially, because midshipmen at the Naval Academy are always violating the rules. So essentially there'd be nobody left after about 6 months. And so there's a pragmatic aspect to it, but I just thought what a really, really high bar for ethical behavior that he had, and he's still one of the most moral people I know.
There's a difference between whether this comes as from within, as something that you can't help, as is the how Alfred kind of positions whistleblowers, that they can't not do this, even though they probably wouldn't do it again if they had the choice, as he says, and that would be more kind of a psychoanalytic, I think, view of it, and between choosing not to, for the virtue of being a virtuous person, right? So in the case of your friend, I think that was more the latter, that it was a choice to not do that in order to be ethical, moral, upstanding, whatever, as opposed to a compulsion.
Yes,
And I think there's an agency difference there, you know, that might be important.
Well, I tend to agree with you, but for him, it was almost a compulsion. So I think you're making the right point, but he was almost carrying it to compulsion. Tommy?
Yeah, what I was going to talk about with those honor codes, because they're not confined to the Naval Academy. There's various institutions that have that sort of a thing, trying to encourage people to come forward and correct wrongs. But, you know, the thing that just kind of strikes me is that I'm comparing, say, the whistleblower to the bystanders, to those who perhaps were or should have been aware of the same wrongs that were being committed, but who simply did not come forward. And it just kind of strikes me that a lot of what we're discussing are about acts of commission and how acts of commission draw attention, whereas we do not really apply the same thought or the same level of like acts of omission. You can basically get away with acts of omission. We can defend yourself, you know, by not being, well, in the case of the bosses, it was, I won't even listen. So long as I don't listen, so long as I don't hear what is going on or what is being presented, then I am absolved.
That's a great point. Tom, think about Enron, right? What do the guys at the top say at Enron? I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know it was, you know, was happening. And people were flabbergasted about it, but that's the kind of argument that they made. Your point is excellent. This idea that there's a different moral standard for acts of commission versus acts of omission.
Yeah, where this came to light was in the sexual harassment case in the military about 5 or 6 years ago. And when that was becoming a rising issue, and it was actually there was actually several writings where, you know, the ones who were being targeted in the writings were what were called the careerist bystanders, and those are the ones who basically should have known, you know, essentially who didn't follow up with the honor code or the values of the overall organization, saying that. If you were aware of what was going around you, and it is your responsibility to be aware, then you should have been among those coming forward saying that these acts were going wrong.
It's like, I think being a whistleblower, as I listened repeatedly to these experiences, to me it felt like the earth was receding from below their feet. Literally. I mean, that's my kind of own metaphor, right? And when you say what you have to forgo, what you have to forsake, actually, in page 49, I mean, it's mind-blowing that the individual matters, that law and justice can be relied on, that the purpose of law is to remove the caprice of powerful individual, that ours is a government of laws, not men. And so it goes worse and worse, and becomes worse and worse, right? Concluding with that the individual can know the truth about all this, not become merely cynical unto death, right? And other things. So this is something quite powerful, actually. And for any of us, and I'm sure we all have been in one way or another, well, hopefully not as whistleblowers, but one way or another, we have been in a position where actually we feel that what we say doesn't have any meaning because nobody seems to understand what we're talking about, right? And since we are actually, you know, social animals, and our identity and our subjectivity, to use this psychoanalytic terminology, is actually defined vis-a-vis the other and only vis-a-vis the other through speech. So it's easy to actually understand how this whole meaning collapses when nobody listens. Because if people listen, they would have to actually, how can I say, acknowledge part of what is being said, no? Even positioning oneself vis-a-vis that is a form of acknowledgement. So this is quite crucial. So people don't exist, literally. They are obliterated. That's why, as Alford explains, they are stuck in time. They live in the constant present because they cannot move from that constant present, right?
So one of the things I was thinking about when you were talking about that, and also reading Alford's this idea about the doubling and being able to compartmentalize your morality. Based on your research, do you see anything that suggests that one of the reasons why the coworkers might not be comfortable talking about this or
you cannot be not affected, right, by that. But also you are affected in a negative way, which explains the bystanding issue that was just being discussed, and actually the willful blindness, as Margaret Heffernan puts it, willful blindness, really. It is easy to explain because, you know, when you see what the whistleblower goes through, you just are humanly and simply scared. You don't want to be that castaway. We don't castaway subject. You really don't want to be a non-subject, because what whistleblowers become, they're non-subjects in reality, because they're not just excluded from organization. You know, they're de-skilled. That's clearly the case. Alford gives ample examples. And these are true examples, by the way. I think we found very similar stories. So not only is your kind of skills, your identity, your professional identity stripped away from you, it's your social identity. You become impoverished. And something we haven't as yet discussed is your mental health is being affected very, very badly. And organizations purposefully actually use mental health as a weapon of retaliation. We've just published a paper on that in Journal of Business Ethics. Mental health as a weapon of the weapon for retaliation, actually, you know, and even very strong people like army officers, you know, like people who are, you know, very kind of resilient. I mean, we haven't met a whistleblower who didn't suffer at some point in his or her career from mental health problems. And these are people who never had a history of mental health illness prior to actually them becoming whistleblowers. So, you know, when you see what happens to the whistleblower, and that's why partly organizations actually, this is not the only reason, but this is a very important reason that organizations punish. It's a very Hobbesian view. You know, first of all, organizations punish whistleblowers because they want to protect themselves, very Hobbesian, but also they want to make an example of the whistleblower. So, you know, the people who observe actually are disciplined. I mean, this is, Alford makes this point over and over, but this is a very valid point. So those two reasons, I think, first of all, you just don't want to find yourself in that position. And secondly, and more importantly, I haven't said that yet, it's not just that people are afraid of retaliation. They also see that nothing is being done. So it's a sacrifice in vain. And I think, I don't fully agree with that. I think Alford also in his concluding chapter actually kind of makes a more qualified statement about that sacrifice. I think that whistleblowers are sacrificed, burned, I think, very often. There are changes that result from their action, but in many cases, and in that I disagree with Alford, or maybe his experience is different from what we have observed, actually, you know, Alford seems to be saying that it's a sacrifice that actually doesn't change anything. And whistleblowers are motivated by two things. The first thing is they want the wrongdoing to stop. That's the main thing that motivates them, I think, if we are to talk about that, you know, for reasons that have been explained. And also just before I conclude, I just want to say that motivation thing is that whistleblowers, their narcissistic selves, feel so deeply offended and corrupted by association, by mere fact of being part of that, even if they don't commit themselves, they're part of the organization and therefore tainted by association with an organization that commits wrongdoing. And that's something intolerable for the narcissism of the whistleblower. So I think I made several points, but I think these are all very, very crucial points, at least in my understanding, in my reading of Alford's work.
So one of the points you made, and that the discussion was going towards that before, is that we are very much discussing the question of why not there are more whistleblowers, so to speak, now that there is clear, consequences to becoming a whistleblower, and the different things we listed kind of show why it's something that's not so common, so to speak. And one of the things that you mentioned, and other people were mentioned as well, is this issue of being made an example and how organizations leverage that exactly to prevent future people from speaking up. I was thinking about the beginning of our discussion and how the work of Alford very much tries to undo the romantic idea of what does it mean to be a whistleblower. And I was thinking that maybe that's another instrument that kind of prevents people to have the capacity and courage to speak up. Because if you think about it in a way, if we maintain this idea that to be a whistleblower, you have to be of a certain kind and have this and must have this specific truth that's going to be listened by everyone, that takes away the fact that, as you found in your research, that whistleblowing is actually a much more mundane and ordinary kind of act. So I'm saying all this because one of the things that I wanted us to think about it is, one, where does this romantic idea comes from and whether it is still present in the literature? Because as we know, Alfred wrote this more, you know, 20 years ago. So I was curious to understand more about that.
Where the idea of romantic hero comes from? Is that your question? Or?
Yeah, yes. And whether it still exists in the literature today or if it has been abolished, you know, after all these years.
Oh, of course, there is a lot of, you know, kind of, one researcher, contemporary to Alford, so 2002, he calls whistleblowers as secular saints. I mean, the connotations are very clear, right? Somebody who is perfect. And I don't think that's very helpful to whistleblowers because whistleblowers are flawed people like all of us are. And even whistleblowers may be dysfunctional narcissists. I'm not claiming they are, but even if they are, that's not the point. I'm moving a little bit to implications, you know. The point is that we should play the ball, not the man, to use that kind of gendered metaphor. In a way, we should focus on the nature of disclosure, what the service, because it is a service, no matter where it comes from, no matter what's the motivation. I mean, you know, what whistleblowers do for society is invaluable. Well, let's go to some very, very kind of very, very well-known examples. Edward Snowden, right? Or even Julian Assange, although people differ in their views whether Assange is a whistleblower or just, you know, he's doing a different job. He's really, you know, he's for transparency. So he's really publishing information from trusted sources. You know, he's disclosing. He's like an agency, you know, that discloses. I think more highly of Assange. I mean, some researchers of whistleblowing differ. They say he's not a whistleblower. Well, I think he's in the same camp, in my view. But Ed Snowden, right? You know, it doesn't matter. I mean, for me, it doesn't matter whether this guy is actually a nice person to have a coffee with, you know, or not. I mean, at the end of the day, what matters is what the service, and the service is, and I think in that way, maybe that's why Alford is more pessimistic in the on the issue of impact, of the impact of whistleblowing, right? Okay, I think that the impact has been tremendous in recent years in particular, you know. Just let me give you just a completely different example from health services, okay, in this country, the UK, the National Health Service. So you have a very famous, well, and now forgotten, but famous among people who know the story, anesthetist, Dr. Steve Balsin, who actually, you know, came from a child's hospital in London to Royal Bristol Hospital, and he suddenly noticed that there was a high mortality, you know, following the surgery, pediatric surgery, cardiothoracic pediatric surgery, really high mortality. So he started, I mean, what do you do? You know, what do you do in this case? You are an anesthetist. You cannot ignore that knowledge. It depends what sort of question is being also asked of you. It's one thing to see, for example, you know, I don't know, I don't want to kind of just now kind of, how can I say, rank the wrongdoing, but there are some fundamental issues that touch us more than others. So when you are a medic, and I have been trained in medicine, as you said, actually, you know, I mean, the first thing you learn when you are 18 years old is not to do harm, you know? So in a way, it's very, very difficult to be a medic and be part of an organization that actually, beyond any doubt, is actually implicated in harming patients. That's something that goes completely against the grain of actually of what you have been socialized to since you are 18 when you enter the medical school. I'm just trying to give the, so anyway, so in the impact. So the specific anesthetist has tried to raise it internally with the Department of Health. Well, after some time, he actually became an external whistleblower. And okay, it was a big shock because it's death, it involves death of children and so on, you know, a big uproar, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the guy who could never find a job in the UK, so he works in Australia. This is a true story, actually. But the impact of it is that it shook up actually the way the health system is organized in the UK. So various quality mechanisms were introduced. A lot more money was given. Okay, these were different times, but okay, I'm just saying there was a very tangible impact, actually, you know. Well, you can look at other examples. I don't want to go into, you can go to Pentagon, you know, Watergate, Pentagon Papers, Watergate, many, many other examples. So there was an impact. It's okay, whistleblowers are sacrificed. And probably, Pedro, to answer your question, in the hindsight, when we all benefit from whistleblowers' disclosure, then the very person who was vilified then becomes a heroic individual, you know. We feel, I mean, personal explanation, it makes us feel good about ourselves to actually recognize the service that was actually, you know, performed by this very, I mean, even Nelson Mandela, sorry, I'm moving to a different topic. It's not a case of whistleblowing. Even Nelson Mandela, you know, now, of course, beyond any doubt, universally seen as one of the greatest, rightfully, obviously, seen one of the greatest, you know, role models and heroic individuals. I mean, not so long ago, I'm older than you probably, guys, so I remember that he was really seen as a terrorist by no one else than the Prime Minister of the UK, Margaret Thatcher, right? So, you know, today nobody would dare actually naming Nelson Mandela, call him a terrorist or anything like that, not even refer to his past as terrorist past. So all I'm trying to say, there are various mechanisms. And also Alford refers to that in his final chapter about the philosophy and politics of scapegoating, right? Why do we need scapegoats? The scapegoat performs a function for us. Whistleblowers perform a function for us, right? Not only do they actually tell us how morally deficient organizations may be in many cases, or society even, they also perform a function for us. In the end, we recognize them in order to feel better about ourselves. Sorry if that sounds a bit cynical, what I say. It's not cynical, but I think it's just deep affective mechanisms that are mobilized. Our love of self is protected in that way, to use that terminology that we have explored.
Mm-hmm. So if I understood this correctly, the issue of the romanticism surrounding the idea of the whistleblower is, it's linked to the fact that there are different ways to frame an act, and there is always an attempt to, you know, resist, and, you know, by the organization, whatever it is, to frame it as evil, so to speak. So the romantic idea is something that comes after the fact when a different narrative wins. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. So it's not something from the act itself, but it's this, the fact that there is a contested frame surrounding different kind of acts at this nature.
I think Alford puts it nicely. A hero is a person who has a story to tell, right? Of course, Alford deconstructs that because a hero is vindicated at the end, right? And he says clearly, very few, if any, whistleblowers is vindicated. I'm responding to your question, why we tend to see whistleblowers as heroes, whether it is the reality or not. As Alford tells us, it's not the reality anyway. But that how the framing of heroism functions. It's a hero is a person who has a story to tell, basically. Goes through, like in fairy tales, right? And actually in narratives. And actually, we didn't mention that, but Alford relies on a very nice and unique methodology of a narrative methodology, actually, which is really very nice. I don't know if any of you is really interested in that, but I found this kind of use of narrative methodology very, very powerful as well. Because when we hear a story, what is the good story? A good story has the ability to arrest us, right? To engage our feeling, our affect, right? And I think whistleblowing stories, you know, if they're good stories with a good end, right? Right? Always. They have this power of actually engaging us, right? That's why we really need a good end. We need a happy end in order to retain our belief and the meaning, our belief in what we know to be our social world, in a way, in order to retain the meaning. And Alford is pricking that in a very powerful way. He's just actually tell us, how about if there's no meaning at all? How about if human existence in society is just actually a story of endless submission? And whenever we just stray away from that submission, we are actually destroyed. Okay, I don't fully believe in that, but there is certainly a very, very, okay, it can happen. We know from history, we know, and some of us know more than others, depending, you know, which country do you come from, actually, what kind of history is more familiar to you. And I can certainly empathize with what Alford is telling us. But at the same time, if we are to continue, we must believe that a different ending is possible.
I mean, also, to just add to the hero narrative, I think there's two things there that kind of lend towards that. One is that well, organizations are pervasive and at the same time either faceless or problematic with respect to who the face is, kind of hinting towards the power corruption there. But also Joseph Campbell's hero's journey is basically, with the exception of the ending, the whistleblower's journey, that there is this call to action that they feel that they need to act. Then there's challenges, there's there's revelations, there's the what were the other ones, the abyss that they undergo when once they're retaliated upon, and then there's transformation. Usually there would then be atonement and vindication, which is kind of lacking, but it's basically a an archetypical kind of adventure story that they go through in their reaction to these things that they're blowing their whistle on.
I also think that something very important that he mentions, which is more probably of relevance to our field of study, organizations and management, I think he's quite right in actually saying, I will again use a terminology that I'm more familiar with. I mean, the first goal of any organization, and in fact, every individual, and that I draw from psychoanalysis, is survival. And he probably doesn't use this terminology, but I think that organization enters into a survivalist mode whenever it's threatened. Of course, there is this kind of feudal use of power. I get it. But I think more than anything else, I think the first purpose of any organization is its own maintenance, its own survival, I would say. And I think, you know, we found in our research that NHS was no better in actually in how it retaliated against whistleblowers than banks. Genuinely, there is no difference between actually there is no level, low level that an organization will not stoop, you know, in order to persecute the whistleblower, any organization. Honestly, this is really very chilling. I know, it sounds awful. And when I say,
well, that's what I was thinking when you were describing the Bristol Royal Infirmary. That right. It doesn't matter that, you know, you were talking about the do no harm, and it's, and I don't, I'm sure people weren't consciously saying. That's one of these things I wonder about, at what level of consciousness some of these responses rise to. But I'm sure people weren't saying, no, I'd rather protect my reputation than it's okay to do harm. But I think it is sort of there's a visceral level where we get into these things where there's no level to which they won't stoop, because then it becomes reputation, and very, you know, there's maybe a negative side of narcissism for the people challenged. Right. How dare they challenge me? How dare they bring these things up? How dare you bring the organization into this negative light, the survival stuff that you're talking about? So I just find that fascinating.
And people offer all sorts of justification. We all do, you know. In fact, like, okay, if we didn't do that, somebody else would have done it, you know. I mean, you know, very common.
And that's all for part two of episode 45. Thank you for listening. We hoped you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time, here on Talking About Organizations.